This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. On the program today, we're going to take a look at the circumstances of those who live above the poverty line but below the security of the middle class. Our guest is Catherine Newman. She is the co-author with Victor Tan Chen of The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. Newman and Chen say the nation's promise of opportunity has worked for these Americans, but the problem they face is this: will the gains they've made endure? Newman and Chen say there are a great number of Americans who are near poor. They say 57 million Americans, including 21% of the nation's children, make up this missing class. Catherine Newman is the Forbes Class of 41 Professor of Sociology and Public Affairs at Princeton University. She is the co-author with Victor Tan Chen of The Missing Class. She's also the award-winning author of 8 books on poverty, downward mobility, and school violence. Excerpts of her work have appeared in publications including The New York Times and Newsweek. The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America, is published by The Beacon Press. Professor Newman, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure to talk with you. Well, why do you call the near poor the missing class?
Because they aren't on anybody's radar screen. We spend a lot of time thinking about the poor, that is, those who are below the poverty line, and rightly so, because they are really the most destitute Americans. And, of course, politicians and others pay a lot of attention to the middle class. But this group of people, which lies in between, makes too much money to qualify for most of the federal benefits that we provide to their truly indigent, but doesn't earn enough to be secure. And so they tend not to be on anybody's to-do list, and we think that they need to be paid attention to for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah, well, we'll get to those reasons. I want to ask you here a couple of basic questions, though. What is the poverty level, and then what kind of incomes do the near poor, the missing class, earn?
The poverty level is adjusted, of course, every year for the cost of living to some extent. So right now, the poverty level for a family of four, which is how we usually think about this, is about $20,000 a year. The missing class, the near poor, are above the poverty level, up to twice the poverty level, so that would be $20,000 to $40,000 per year for a family of four.
And where do these Americans, where are they likely to live?
They live everywhere. They live in the Rust Belt, they live in the inner city, they live in rural America, they are service workers, they are mainly people who have non-unionized jobs, so some of the more fortunate do have union cards. So they inhabit kind of the lower reaches of what we might have at one time called the working class, but they tend not to be blue-collar workers, and hence we think this term, the missing class, is more apropos.
Yeah. Now, is the missing class worse off than the working class of yesteryear?
Well, they earn less because, as I said, they're generally not unionized. And they're not in heavy industry. They tend to be in the service sector. And in general, that means their wages are lower than what we used to refer to as the working class. But, of course, these could be considered overlapping categories in some ways, especially if we think about what has happened to blue-collar labor in the United States. By defining this by income, we could include lots and lots of people who are at the lower reaches of the manufacturing industries. But the prototypical missing class worker is a daycare worker, someone who works cleaning subway cars here in New York, a health aide. These are the kinds of people who we think of when we talk about the near poor in America.
Yeah. One of the things that comes through loud and clear, I think, in your book, The Missing Class, is that this group of people, the near poor, is hardworking, often quite ambitious.
Well, exactly. They are near poor rather than really poor, in part because they work so many hours and often hold down more than one job and frequently have more than one job in their household. It's only by working so many hours that they keep themselves up above the poverty line for the most part. Nonetheless, for those who used to be genuinely poor, being in this particular income bracket is a real improvement. And many of the people that we studied for this book live in inner city neighborhoods of New York and know very well what it means to be genuinely destitute. They've worked their way out of that category and did so largely in the late 90s and the early part of this decade when the economy was much better than it is today. And they were able to grab the opportunities that were becoming available when labor markets tightened and move up by finding better jobs and move up by working more hours.
Yeah. I've got a listener who would like to talk with you. So before I get into the next question that I have, let's not have this individual wait too much longer. We've got a listener in Indiana on line four waiting to talk with you. Good afternoon.
Have you ever worked in a place?
Excuse me, could you repeat that? What was your question?
Okay, excuse me a second. I'm going to get away from the radio so there won't be any
feedback. Okay, we appreciate that.
I'm presuming from the start that people who are Medicare and who rely on just Medicare, who cannot afford supplementary insurance policies, no matter what form they come in, whether through industry or in private organizations that send it through the mail, that when it comes down to the 17 to 25% they have to pay on drugs and or, you know, medical stuff or surgery, they just can't handle it. So eventually they lose their credit rating, whatever they might have had before that. And I always thought that was sort of a desperate situation. I know people in my family are all over in that situation. And, of course, losing your credit in this economy is, you know, is basically makes you poor again, and you don't have any means to get to food stamps or anything because of the cutoff point is not where you are. Or if you can make a comment about that.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Well, medical problems, especially the high cost of medical insurance, is a real serious issue for the missing class. These days, of course, we hear a great deal, and rightfully so, about the uninsured, the 47 million Americans who lack all health insurance. And there certainly are many people in the missing class in that situation. But even more of them are what I would call weakly insured. That is, they have insurance policies that will take care of them under catastrophic conditions, but not the kind of ordinary medical expense that most people incur all the time. And this means that they don't get the kind of preventive care they need. It means that they tend not to be seen by physicians until their conditions are well far advanced, and that means difficult to treat and expensive. So if we combine the uninsured with the weakly insured, we have a much bigger problem than we usually acknowledge. And as the caller suggested, people in this income bracket are not qualified for Medicaid. That is, they earn too much for the health programs we provide to the very poor. They quickly do run through the money they have to put aside for health expenses like drugs. In terms of credit, I actually find their problem is not that they can't get credit, but that they are overextended and in serious trouble with extremely high consumer debts, often caused by medical expenditures. People often don't realize that one of the chief sources of bankruptcy in the United States is medical expenditures, not fancy cars and jewelry. And that is often the problem for the missing class. So we do need to address the health needs, and we have not failed to do so for so many Americans. For example, the children in this group, the children of the missing class, would probably have been the single biggest beneficiaries of the SCHIP bill that was before Congress earlier this term. Because their families are in that category where they tend not to be offered either good health insurance or health insurance at all by employers, but to be earning too much for Medicaid. And having set that bill aside, we find that they're just in just as much trouble as they ever were.
You're tuned to The Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon, Catherine Newman, co-author of The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. Well, we were talking about health care, and maybe let's put a face on this issue. Tell us about Gloria Hall.
Gloria Hall is actually from Panama, and she worked for New York City for many, many years. As a security guard, she had actually fairly reasonable health insurance, but not good enough to take care of her when a very serious cancer of the thyroid struck her, and it was not diagnosed until very, very late on, in part because she really didn't have the kind of health insurance that would cover the sort of diagnostic tests that were needed to address a condition that turned out to be extremely serious. At the point that I got to know her, she had three children and was divorced. Her oldest child was serving in the military and had done quite well. But her two younger children were really in trouble, largely because Gloria, as a single mother who was very ill, just didn't have what it took to take care of them very well anymore. She was just exhausted all the time and in great discomfort, and they were acting up as kids often do when their parents get sick. But with as a single parent, she really had very little in the way of a backstop. She found that because her health insurance would not cover these very elaborate diagnostic tests, she really had to let go of virtually all of her assets and impoverish herself to the point where she qualified for Medicaid. At that point, she was able to make use of the excellent facilities at the Sloan Kettering Cancer Center here in New York, one of the best treatment facilities in the country. But by that time, she was really very far gone, and I haven't seen her in a number of years. I would be surprised if she's still with us, to be honest. She was so sick. So she illustrates what happens when people kind of fall through this crack of the weakly insured rather than the uninsured. And, you know, she was a hardworking woman, had worked all her life, and like many other people in the missing class, had never been on public assistance, very proud of her track record as a worker, as a productive person, but nonetheless confronted this absolute nightmare of problems connected to her health.
Yeah, you wonder how somebody like that manages to get day-to-day, go day-to-day.
Well, it was not hard, not easy for Gloria, and there were many days when really she couldn't even leave her apartment. It was just too much for her. And that is a problem that many missing class households face. They are really one illness away from falling back down below the poverty line. And one of the things I want to stress here is that this need not be the case. We don't have to look upon these people as destined for destitution or destined for a terrible life. In fact, they don't think of themselves that way, which is the optimistic part of this book. This book is really about people who pulled themselves up the hard way and are proud of their accomplishments, and they really don't want anybody else's handouts. They want to be self-sufficient and have worked very hard to do that. It's just that at the wages they earn, they really are not secure, and anything that goes wrong, particularly those that are in single-parent households, leaves them extremely vulnerable.
Hmm. Speaking of a hard worker, tell us about Tomas Linares.
Tomas Linares hailed from Puerto Rico as a young man, came to the mainland when he was a young teenager, had a pretty tough life, was not an angel, as he himself would say. He had two daughters, was divorced, and his mother, his elderly mother, had come from Puerto Rico for him to help take care of her. He worked two jobs. He worked 5 days a week as a hospital orderly, and he worked 2 days a week, the other weekend days, in a facility for the mentally disabled. And so working 7 days a week, Tomas assembled a grand income of about $20,000 a year, which puts him squarely inside the missing class as an adult with no young dependents. But that money was stretched in about a million ways. His daughters needed help from him from time to time. His mother needed his help. His girlfriend wanted her part. Tomas had very little left for himself, and so he lived a very modest lifestyle. But only by working 7 days a week was he able to manage. And that was quite a triumph from his point of view, and he was proud of that accomplishment, but not an easy life for him.
Yeah. What does the stress of being near poor mean for relationships?
Well, it's very difficult to for men and women, for husband and wife, to manage these circumstances. There's tremendous stress on their finances, and they worry a lot about the future. But I also found, and this was sort of news to me, if you will, that there's a great deal of secrecy inside these households about money. Often this is because they are recombinant families, that is, families that have come together after a previous relationship or divorce was in the picture. Mothers with children whose fathers are no longer connected to them don't really want their new husbands to know how the money in the household is being spent, if it's being spent, as of course it must be, on children to whom this new husband is not related. And so we found that when they're skating close to the edge of their resources, there's a lot of secrecy. The wives don't know what the husbands earn. The husbands don't know how the wives are spending the money. Everybody's keeping things sort of quiet and hoping that no one else will notice where the money's going to. And so very often a wife will receive support from a husband to pay utility bills, and she'll buy a pair of sneakers for her child, for the father's stepchild, and they won't pay the utility bill. And then they'll try and intercept the bill that, with the final due notice stamped on it, that comes the next month. Even in households where there's no secrecy, this problem of having to shuffle bills around, paying one this month, putting the other creditors off, trying to stave off the credit card dunning notices, puts a great deal of strain on the family.
And what difficulties do the near poor face in terms of dealing with banks and with getting credit?
Well, they don't have very much trouble getting credit because credit cards are constantly after them to take up new accounts. They are flooded with requests to sign up for new credit cards. And because they tend not to be very well-educated consumers, that often looks like a solution to their debt woes. Instead, it just makes things worse. They don't realize very often how expensive it is to buy things that way. Of course, many millions of Americans are in exactly the same situation. We are awash in consumer debt, which is a very serious problem for millions of American households. But for the near poor, it's particularly devastating because it's so expensive if you just pay the minimum balance every month, which is what they often do. They're spending three times as much to purchase the same goods because they're doing it through credit cards with high interest rates. They're also not very well protected from the credit card companies because of the refinements and reforms in the bankruptcy laws, which now make most consumers much more vulnerable than they once were. So it's a real problem that not so much accessing credit in terms of getting credit cards, but paying off the credit once they have it. Now, the near poor are also trapped in ways that are we still have yet to fully understand in the subprime lending explosion. To the extent that the near poor are homeowners, and of course they are less likely to be homeowners than more wealthy Americans, but they still, many of them are, it's probably because they had a subprime mortgage. Generally speaking, if you don't have high enough income or if your credit is a little bit rocky, the subprime market is where you will end up, and that's exactly what happened to the family that we describe in the very beginning of this book, the Floyd family.
Mm-hmm.
As it turns out, the Floyds didn't have a mortgage. What they did was they, like many other low-income families, they couldn't afford to keep their home up, and so when it ran into trouble, when the roof sprang a leak, they were victimized by a predatory contractor who came and offered to fix the roof of the house. All they had to do was sign this paperwork, and not knowing really what they were signing, they signed away their right to that home after the first missed payment. And because the interest rates being charged were absolutely through the roof and should have been illegal, they lost their home. This is happening to hundreds of thousands of Americans, not just through the mortgage system, but through this, these sort of predatory lenders who know that they're vulnerable and know that they don't know, understand what it is they're signing away. So the Floyds today live more or less across the street from the home they once owned, except now they're in a one-bedroom apartment with nine people. And it's a real tragedy that they lost the one most important asset. Of course, they're about to be followed by some 2 million American households who will fall into this predatory lending subprime crisis. And the loss of that asset has enormous ramifications for the future for these families. They are, have just lost the only really meaningful asset they have. It's the one source of support that many people turn to for paying medical bills, borrowing against for medical bills, for college expenses for children. For millions of Americans, the 68-some-odd percent of us who are homeowners, home equity is our own private safety net, and it's about to melt away for millions caught in this subprime crisis, of whom a goodly proportion are in the missing class.
Yeah, and those nine people include John and Sandra Floyd and seven grandchildren.
That's exactly right. And, you know, if they could have held on to that home, especially in a rising real estate market, which is what we had in their neighborhood until fairly recently, it could have not only supported them in old age, but been an asset that could have been inherited by their children. And we really tend to underestimate sometimes how important that asset is in smoothing out the inequalities that exist in other markets like the labor market.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Catherine Newman. She and Victor Tan Chen are the authors of The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Let's go back to the phones now and take a call from a listener in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Good. I have a number of comments and something of a question, but on the 47 million uninsured, I read this not only on the Chicago Tribune editorial page, but listened to what's his name? Huckabee on Charlie Rose explained that of the 47 million, one third are uninsured because they're too wealthy; they don't need insurance. One third are so young they think they're immortal, and the other one third are truly needy. And that point was not followed up by Mr. Rose, and it was repeated on the Chicago Tribune editorial page at some point later. Some of the economists at Chicago, the University of Chicago, have maintained that the bankruptcy problem from healthcare debts come about only because those that get in trouble with healthcare don't manage their credit cards and their financial affairs well enough to start with. The medical debts wouldn't collapse them if they did. Point number three, if you add up the 47 million and the 50 million or so that you're talking about that are the missing class, you have approximately one third of this nation somewhat in serious trouble economically. Four, my comment is cui bono? Who benefits from this type of economic structure? And I think it's probably fairly self-evident, but I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, let me start with the first point. It is true that a lot of young people, especially those in their early 20s, that is, they're out of college, but they're not yet employed in the kinds of jobs that offer health insurance, are a big chunk of the uninsured population. And it's not because they don't want health insurance. It's because they can't afford it. And, of course, you know, they can hope, and we can all hope, they don't get hit by a truck or find some other reason why they would need health care. And probably on average, they're less likely to need it than others because they are young people. They're not yet hitting all the disabilities that come with old age. Nonetheless, it's a serious problem for anybody to be without health care. I would love to see Mr. Huckabee's comments about where this one-third who are so wealthy that they don't need health insurance could possibly be coming from. I've never seen any data to support such a claim. It's relatively few Americans who are well enough off to be able to withstand what high, expensive medical treatment could cost if you really find yourself with a serious illness or an accident. And I would challenge anyone to show us that one-third of the 47 million are actually so wealthy that they don't need health insurance. I find that really quite ludicrous. The youth part I could certainly imagine, and then of course we've got a large number of people who simply don't earn enough to purchase it, or more to the point, they don't work for employers who offer it, and that's really the problem. If you in a healthcare system like ours, where in general insurance, if you're not in the Medicaid or Medicare system, is provided through private employment, and you happen to work for an employer that doesn't provide it, the cost of securing medical insurance outside such a group plan is enormously expensive, and that's where so many of these people will fall. In terms of the bankruptcy problem, again, I think we should really think through what it means that medical costs are such a primary mover in bankruptcy. It is certainly the case that not everyone who gets into such trouble is an angel with respect to how they've used credit cards before, but the notion that medical care itself is pushing them into bankruptcy should tell us that the problem is less a matter of their consumer behavior and more a matter of a ridiculous healthcare system that no other country on the planet makes use of because it leaves so many people incredibly vulnerable. In terms of who benefits, well, I don't think anybody benefits from the presence of such a large number of Americans who are either poor or near poor. They themselves, of course, suffer from various forms of economic disability and insecurity. The rest of us face costs that their presence incurs if they end up in emergency rooms because they don't have health care, if they, you know, fall down below the poverty line and require public assistance, meager as it may be. If they're, even more importantly, if their children fall behind in school and constitute a next generation of poor Americans. All of this is a drag on our economy. They can't be as effective as consumers, as taxpayers, as contributors to the nation's productivity. And in other countries where we don't see such a serious problem, you see people who have a higher standard of living, longer life expectancy, and all of those things contribute to their very positive bottom lines. No nation can really afford to have so many people falling below a middle-class standard of living and think that it's somehow the greatest nation on earth.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
Hi. It's been a casual observation that probably the percentage of people falling into this class, the missing class, has been increasing in the last 30 or so years. And if that observation is correct, I'm wondering with what right people call the time since which it started, the Reagan Revolution, and what has this Reagan Revolution really brought to this country that is positive as far as common people are concerned. And I don't know if that observation is correct or not, but I'll hang up and listen.
Well, originally when I started down the road for this book, I thought that I would find that the missing class had grown enormously. In fact, it has always been with us, and while there was certainly growth in their ranks from about 40 million up above 50 million in the 1980s, in fact, it's always been a pretty substantial proportion of the American population. It certainly got worse even before Reagan. It got worse starting in the mid-1970s when we began to lose so many of the high-wage jobs that migrated either to non-unionized areas of the U.S. or began the long march offshore. We had a high-wage industrial structure until the mid-1970s, and then we start to see it crumble and erode. And the growth of service sector occupations that took the place, if you will, of those higher-wage blue-collar manufacturing jobs produced millions more missing class workers. So we've seen a fundamental change in the character of the American occupational structure and economy, and that has tended to create more service sector jobs, which are more likely than other jobs to be inhabited by the missing class. So I don't think we can pin it all on Ronald Reagan by any means. I don't think it was helped by the kinds of policies that were brought into play during conservative administrations, which tended to tip toward the very wealthy in terms of tax policy, for example. But we're seeing a bigger sea change in the nature of the American economy that favors the growth of this group, if you will. And they do better when labor markets are very tight. But in periods of recession, such as the one we're about to plunge into, this group is really quite vulnerable, and their ranks tend to grow.
Yeah. Also, it was interesting for me to see how, when I want to talk about Danielle Walker, how on the one hand, if I'm recalling her story correctly, welfare reform helped her in one sense in terms of getting into the workplace, and she actually is working a welfare job. I mean, she's in the welfare office. But at the same time, welfare reform has also changed the classroom where the children of classrooms where the children of the near poor are, and that was an interesting kind of thing to think about in terms of what kinds of policies do we enact and what are, you know, what how do we sort out the good effects and the from the bad.
Yes, Danielle Walker is a very interesting case because she illustrates a point that I think most of us don't think about, which is how policies clash when they surround a family that is having to respond to multiple policy directions that probably didn't take the alternatives into account. So Danielle was on welfare for quite some time. She was extremely depressed, in part because she felt she had no control over her future. And welfare reform, combined with a roaring labor market in the late 90s, both pushed and pulled her back into the economy, initially as a welfare worker, that is to say she was working off her stipend. And while this is not true for everyone who exited off the welfare rolls this way, for Danielle it actually provided an opportunity to get a foot in the door of the Human Resources Administration in New York City, where she got a job. She had many other jobs along the way, I should point out. Although she was on welfare for a time, it really wasn't a very long time. Like most welfare recipients, Danielle was in and out of the labor market, but mostly in minimum wage jobs. She finally got a job working for the Welfare Administration as a program administrator, basically handling paperwork for other welfare clients. And for the first time in many, many years, she began to feel as though she had some degree of control over her life. She was earning a living. She moved off of the welfare rolls altogether and was hired as a regular civil service employee in the Human Resources Department. For the first time, she felt like she had a future ahead of her. And she is really a success story from this point of view. And it's important to recognize that those people who, for whatever reasons, are out of the labor force, although they are able-bodied adults, never feel right about that, never. They don't enjoy being on public assistance. If you have three children, sometimes you don't have too many other options. But in her case, you know, it was really a drag on her psychology to be out of the labor force and spending her days at home just with young children. So when she went back to work, it was really a new day for her. But her children were in a very different state. When Danielle was not working, she was very active in their school. She spent part of her time as a PTA volunteer. She knew all the teachers. She took her kids to the library. She was absolutely determined that they were going to do well. So in the summertime, they would get these little gold stars for reading 25 books at the public library. She knew exactly what the best options were for her kids in the schools they went to, and they were not great schools. So having a parent behind you to kind of make sure that you get the best teachers that are available and to watch out over you is really important for children in these fairly impoverished and overcrowded and sometimes violent schools. When Danielle went back to work, she couldn't be in two places at once, and so what got subtracted was the kind of oversight she could provide for her children in school. So she doesn't know the teachers anymore, and she can't go to the school to advocate for her kids. She's at work all day. She doesn't really have the energy to take them to the library the way she once did. And you can see the difference in her children. Her older children, who benefited from all that attention to their academic performance, did reasonably well in school. Her youngest child, who was 2 years old when I first met the family, was put into a very substandard daycare situation, basically a family daycare system in which there were drug addicts wandering in and out because Danielle didn't earn enough money and we didn't, as a nation, put enough money into early childhood education to afford anything more than really custodial care of the kind that was not going to produce a very education-ready kid at the kindergarten age when that little girl finally found her way to kindergarten. Her vocabulary was totally stunted. All that she could say at the age of about three was no and shut up, and that's all she'd say when I would come to visit. And this is partly, I think, because that's all she heard during the day when she was in childcare. So we have a kind of a paradox here, and it's one that I don't think policymakers think about very much. The forces that both drove and pulled Danielle into the labor market and which gave her a kind of financial floor she could put under her children and a sense of optimism for her own future may well have sealed the fate of the next generation, which is not likely to follow in her footsteps if they end up doing poorly in school, dropping out of school, which is what's happening in many a missing class neighborhood. These are the kids who are getting caught in the No Child Left Behind squeeze. They're the ones who are failing those third grade tests and being held back in school. And if they're held back, that is almost always a one-way ticket to being a high school dropout. So we really need to think hard about what it means if we push policies in directions that just don't compute inside a family like her family. Doing well by one generation is a good thing. It genuinely is, and she would never dispute that. But if it causes a repetition of a poverty pattern in the next generation, then we might have solved this problem in, you know, for a short space, only to see it rearise like a hydra in the next generation.
Yeah. A part of the good news about the missing class is at the end of the book, and also sprinkled throughout, are people who are thinkers and problem solvers. Peter Tufano at Harvard, he's working on the savings issue. Joan Fitzgerald at Northeastern, working on career ladders. There's a fellow by the name of Mark Levine who found credit where credit is due. What kinds of things are people talking about in and out of the academy about solving this problem with in education with what you've just talked about, this youngest child of Danielle Walker?
Well, there are a lot of good ideas out there, and I'm actually reasonably optimistic with respect to the ideas we have. Now what we need is the political will and the right composition of Congress and the White House to make a dent on these problems. And they begin all the way with that two-year-old in Danielle's household. Lots of good thinking and a lot of comparative research looking at other countries that do a better job than we do on early childhood education. We have to be able to level the playing field between families that are well-endowed, like mine, whose kids got a first-class child care situation and entered kindergarten very well-prepared, and families like Danielle's, where that two-year-old isn't going to know her colors and numbers when she starts kindergarten, and she will fall behind. She'll already be behind before she even graces the door of her kindergarten. So we need, desperately, early childhood education that is universally available, as countries like Italy routinely provide, and France. Countries that have a lot less wealth than we do, but who invest in their youngest citizens in order that they're school-ready and don't fall behind. Then we need to do more, and as many the scholars in this book have written, to level the playing field for older kids, to provide them with after-school care that is enriched, academically enriched, so that when their parents are spending, you know, 80 hours a week in the workplace, they don't lose because there are others who can help with their homework, help them keep on the straight and narrow, not leave them unsupervised as teenagers. And then there's, of course, access to a college education, which is ever more critical for joining the middle class. We are marching in the wrong direction along those lines. It's becoming harder for kids to afford a college education and ever more important that they have it.
Mm. Let's take one more call before we're totally out of time. Listener in Champaign, line one, hi.
Yes, hi. I just have two quick comments, one regarding the health care. My brother is a doctor, and we've had this discussion lots of times, and I went for a short period of time without health care when I was transitioning from college, and I got a job that didn't provide health care, and I didn't have the money for it. And I think that people that have health care and have always had health care, they don't really realize what it's like to not have it, or, you know, the difficulties and the expense and all that. And I think, so when you're talking sometimes about politicians and people that are policymakers, many of them have always been in a situation where they've had it, and they don't really have an understanding of what it's like to be in a situation where you don't, and the exorbitant cost of trying to afford it. My other comment is about the woman, Danielle, you were speaking about.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you talk about people that, you know, on the welfare system and the different needs and education and all of that, the only comment I have is also, though, at some level, where is their accountability in the sense of, like, for example, where was these children's father in terms of his economic support of his children as well, not just the burden being entirely upon her, and also just, you know, the responsibility of people to, I guess, to put it kind of bluntly, is like to not have too many more children than they can afford to have. And because then that becomes a burden on the rest of society. And I do a lot of work with animal rescue, and I know with that, I mean, it's just the animals are endless because people don't consider their economic situation and things like that before they get these animals.
And I'm going to jump in. I'm going to jump in because I think we got the gist of where you're coming from.
Okay.
And you made a number of comments, and we're running way down on time here. So let's get Catherine Newman's comments.
Let me be very brief then. It is certainly true that many politicians don't appreciate how difficult it is for people. So do many Americans not really understand how destitute and anxious people can become if they don't have health insurance. And I think a heavy dose of public understanding is what is called for here, because that's where the political will to solve this problem comes from. As far as where are these fathers, I think that's an excellent question. In Danielle's case, she was divorced. Her husband, or her ex-husband, had been an abusive father, and she, you know, she ran from this man because he was bad news. And I think we would have expected that was the right thing for her to do. You wouldn't have wanted her children to put up with this abuse, or her either. He did, to his credit, actually provide child support. So it's not the case that he was an absent dad, but he was a low-wage earner, too. And we have to realize that extracting blood from a stone is very difficult. If you've got two low-wage earners, it's certainly better than one, but you separate them into two different households as a consequence of divorce, and neither one has enough money to support the family.
There we have to leave it. We are out of time. Catherine Newman, thank you so much for talking with
us. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Catherine Newman and Victor Tan Chen are the authors of The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. The book is published by The Beacon Press. And that was an interview from the WILL AM archives. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and we will reschedule the interview that we had planned for today with historian Eve LaPlante. She is the author of Salem Witch Judge, The Life and Repentance of Samuel Sewall. We'll talk with her later this month or next month, probably.